Hi, podcast listeners. It's Chris Boyd. On KERA Radio, we're busy hosting our winter membership campaign. It's one of the few times each year when we ask listeners to support the programming that KERA provides by making financial contributions to the station. Well, we've decided to experiment with cutting those pitch breaks from the podcast. You won't hear the phone number and wonder if anyone is actually standing by at that very moment to take your call. But we would still really appreciate it if you are able to contribute. Your donation goes to support all the programming you hear on KERA, including our streaming service. And most importantly, it pays for this podcast so that you can listen to Think wherever you are in the world, whenever you are in time. You can make your contribution online at kera.org. It only takes a minute. In fact, you could do it while listening to this podcast. Thanks for listening to Think. Here's today's show.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How serious is the problem of poverty in North Texas, and what kinds of coordinated efforts might offer both short-term relief and long-term financial stability to those who struggle to cover their basic needs? An estimated 260,000 Dallasites live in poverty, with another 20% at risk of it in the event of any kind of financial setback. This month, Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings announced plans for a task force to address poverty in the city, and he asked City Square President and CEO Larry James to lead it. Larry James is scheduled also to be a panelist at KERA's One Crisis Away live event this Thursday evening at 7 at the Dallas City Performance Hall. You can reserve a ticket for this free public forum at cfttexas.org. And Larry, welcome back to Think.
Always good to be here, Chris. Thanks.
How did the idea for the Poverty Task Force arise, and what makes it different from other efforts in the past to look at poverty in this community?
We have a mayor in Mayor Rawlings who takes this very seriously. He studied it deeply, and he's spoken often about it recently. And Mike's the kind of person who really is uncomfortable preaching to others without taking significant action himself. I know at one of the forums earlier this month, he said in sort of his self-deprecating humor, someone needs to call the mayor. The conversation was about poverty and race. And so he reached out to me saying, I want, and here's how this is different. I've got a short-term assignment for you. I want a briefing for city council by May on poverty in Dallas. And I want five or six ideas about things that I can do now. I want quick wins, which is just typical of the mayor, that show some progress. We can't just talk about this. We have to act. And so this is a very different kind of task force. He said, you know, I'm not trying to solve world hunger or boil the ocean. I want some quick deliverables that I can go to work on over the next 6 months to 12 months. And I want us to understand more about the problem we face. And so there's not going to be a 500-page report. This task force is not going to meet for 18 months. If in discovering the ideas, the mayor wants us to take these further and do more, then we'll consider whether or not we can do that. But this is a kind of a SWAT team operation to get something done quickly.
So for folks who are working down there in the trenches, are the five or six deliverables incredibly obvious, or is that the one thing that really doesn't exist?
Yeah, I laughed a bit and told the mayor that there aren't many of those ideas. We intend to gather a group of really bright people from across many sectors to spend a good bit of a day together coming up with ideas. But one thing that is apparent to me is a program like the Earned Income Tax Credit Program. Other Texas cities are really outperforming Dallas in terms of drawing those funds back to their communities. For example, last year, San Antonio, through their VITA program, filed over 35,000 tax returns that garnered the city economy about $60 million in tax returns to working people. Dallas, during that same period of time, prepared about 7,000 returns and got $16 million back. We're behind the curve. And we've got to figure out why, and we've got to figure out how we can execute more cleanly and effectively so that every person who's eligible, who's working and eligible for the program, can receive their benefit back.
So this is theoretically thousands of dollars that can go straight back into the pockets of working poor people.
That is exactly right. People who work can be refunded up to almost $4,000 a year. And, of course, that allows them to make choices about savings, about fixing a car or buying a new car or clothing for school or whatever. But the interesting thing about these dollars is they circulate almost immediately in the economy. Mm-hmm. And so we're all in this together. And I think that's the other thing that's motivating this mayor. He's taking a longer-term view of the problem, and he's telling us that Dallas in 2025 is not going to be anything like we want it to be if we don't address these problems that are underneath the surface for the most part of our community's success and brightness. And so the Earned Income Tax Credit program is an obvious one.
Excuse me for interrupting. Are there people who qualify that simply either don't know it exists or don't know? It's not something that you can qualify for if you just fill out a 1040 EZ. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's a special form. It's not that complicated. I think it is true that many people do not understand it. I think it's also true that many people who do understand it go to tax preparation outfits and pay a premium to get those returns done. What we're talking about is a citywide effort that wouldn't cost the filer anything. And so that's just part of the reality or the landscape of that program.
How does poverty in Dallas compare with other cities of this size across the United States?
Well, you know, one in four of us are living in poverty. That allows us to wake up every morning thanking God for Detroit, Memphis, and Philadelphia. We're number four. A person in Dallas, Texas, is more likely to be dealing with poverty than in any of the 20 largest cities in the United States. Dallas is the richest poor town probably in the world. There are really two cultures here, and the gap is widening between them. And so it's a very serious problem. One in three of our children live at or below the poverty line. Children's Medical Center put out the ABC report again this year, a phenomenal piece of research. And the findings relative to poverty were not encouraging.
Can you talk about the poverty line and whether it's really an appropriate measure of the difference between being too poor to cover your basic needs and living a middle-class existence?
Yeah, well, the poverty line for a family of four today is $23,550. And that's an antiquated index because it was first formulated and calculated against what it cost a family to provide food for themselves. About 25% of the income was the expectation. We need a new way to calculate this line, this poverty line. Cost of living needs to be factored in. Regional considerations need to be factored in. The value of dollars need to be adjusted for inflation or whatever. For example, the minimum wage today is roughly equivalent to the minimum wage, in 1968. And so we need an update on how we calculate and how we regard these things. A living wage job for a single person it must pay something around $9 to $9.50 an hour. Minimum wage is $7.25.
And has been since 2009.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And I was about to say earlier, one of the things the mayor mentioned to me in our last meeting was, let's see if we can't figure out some things that I can do by executive order. And, of course, one of the things that came up was minimum wage. What could Dallas as a city, what could the city of Dallas entity, the institution, do about minimum wage and living wage as it relates to its employees? Or what could it do about minimum wage as it relates to people with whom it contracts? And so those are considerations as well.
This is kind of an end run around some municipalities across the country have actually instituted local minimum wages for anyone
correct.
Working within the city rather than being contracted by the city.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
When you raise the minimum wage to something like a living wage, there are discussions about whether it's an immediate boon for the people who are working at that level or whether it makes the goods and services that those individuals themselves are apt to spend money on cost more.
Yeah. If there is a ripple effect, it's long term. And I like what the mayor said recently publicly in his speech. This economy is robust enough to more than absorb an adjustment in minimum wage to get people to equity. There's always the cry that jobs are lost if you raise wages, and there's research that goes on both sides of that that question, if you will. But the net effect of an increase in minimum wage helps workers, it helps families, and it lifts people out of poverty.
What's been the effect on Texas of Governor Perry's decision not to accept the expansion of Medicaid in Texas?
It has not been good. And again, the mayor is on the record, if you will, publicly criticizing that move. It makes no sense whatsoever. I don't think there's a hospital system in Texas that would agree with that stance. It's $19 billion, as I understand it, over a 10-year period. It's actually our money. We've already paid it. And so it's now going to go somewhere else because the governor, probably for ideological reasons, is not going to allow it to be drawn down as long as he's governor to help expand Medicaid. That said, Medicaid is complicated. The reimbursement rates for Medicaid are so low that even if I qualify and enroll in a Medicaid health product, finding a doctor who will take Medicaid these days is getting more and more difficult. The other thing about that, however, is the expansion of Medicaid would certainly, I think, help the public hospital system here in Dallas. And there may be ways to discover and to create, and these may be some of the big ideas we come up with, how private hospitals, nonprofit hospitals could also benefit from Medicaid expansion. We need to up the reimbursement on Medicaid. It's expensive being poor. And frankly, our society responds to poverty kind of on the cheap. You know, the placebo effect of having good health insurance has a lot to do with hope and your understanding of your own self-worth.
Hmm.
We don't often think like that, but if you kind of live by the golden rule and kind of try to put yourself in the position of someone else, you can get in touch with that pretty quickly. How would I want to be treated? How would I want my children to be treated if I was on Medicaid or if I couldn't get on Medicaid? So, you know, it's a spiritual thing as well as an economic thing.
Larry James is with us. He is president and CEO of City Square and leader of the mayor's new poverty task force in Dallas. He is in town, or he is scheduled to appear as a panelist in KERA's One Crisis Away live event this Thursday evening at 7 at the Dallas City Performance Hall. You can reserve a ticket for the free public forum at cfttexas.org. We'll come back to our conversation in just a moment.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Summer Youth, with more than 30 new programs for students entering kindergarten through 12th grade at SMU in Plano from June through August. Registration opens March 5th at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to Larry James as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. He is president and CEO of City Square and leader of the new Dallas Poverty Task Force. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Larry, in a country where we treasure this notion that anybody can rise to any level with enough hard work, what have you learned about why multi-generational poverty continues to plague us?
Well, the notion that anyone through hard work can rise to the top or into the middle class even is kind of comfortable poster child approach to the reality of economics in the nation. A lot of things contribute to generational poverty. Poor education, inadequate nutrition, substandard housing. There's a big link between learning and poverty. There's a big link between education and hope. We found that kids read at grade level if they feel like there's a reason to read at grade level, if they can see a future. There are just all these complicating factors that people sort of are affected by dramatically. And then when cataclysmic things like health problems or even, you know, the failure of an automobile. Just the slightest thing can interrupt the flow of work. And then work is huge because not only is work essential to move forward, what's also essential is a living wage attached to that work. And while American productivity has increased dramatically in the past 30 years, American earning power has not. I saw some data this week that indicated that the typical low-income worker in America today is much more educated than the typical low-income worker was in 1968. And so there are other factors at work underneath here that keep people held back, that hold people back. And so it's not as simple as hard work. You know, I've said for years that hard work, laziness, and hard work too, for that matter, laziness and sorriness are spread across the socioeconomic continuum at about the same depth. Those really aren't the factors that contribute to success financially or failure financially. There are other systemic realities. The way the credit system works. If you're a low-income person and you need credit, you often will settle for what you can get in a bind, and then you find yourself in the payday lending cycle.
30% interest.
Or how about 450% interest by the time you calculate all the fees and all those kinds of things. And so low-income people do not have access to the same opportunities that middle-income and upper-income people have. And a lot of it is systemic. And a lot of the systemic answers, if you will, or initiatives to address this problem have gone away. I read recently that in Dallas, there are only 76 – in Dallas County, there are only 7,600 children receiving TANF benefits or welfare benefits. And so the safety net has worn very thin. There's a lot of our families are in free fall. The concentration of poverty in neighborhoods is amazing. In three zip codes in South Dallas, there are 50,000 people who are living at 60% of the poverty level. Mm-hmm. It's amazing the depth of poverty. 10% of us live at 50% of poverty in this city. And that's kind of the untold story. Those are depression numbers. And so we're not talking about just recession affecting everybody, which, of course, it did. And now we're coming back, thankfully. But we also have part of our population living in depression-type conditions. And then we wonder why our public schools are challenged. So it's complicated. Certainly hard work is essential. But I know so many. I mean, we serve thousands. Last year, 55,000 different low-income working people. And the vast majority work hard and diligently, but they don't earn enough, and they have other factors working against them that really don't have anything to do with their effort or lack thereof.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sean in Dallas. Hello, Sean.
Hello. Hey, you're so right on about the Medicaid expansion, because we're losing $100 billion, I believe, in the next 10 years. And we pay about $500 million here in Dallas County just for uncompensated care. And a lot of that would be covered, you know, with the Medicaid expansion. And I agree with you, too. I think as long as we have a Republican governor, we just may never see that. And the sad thing about it is we're actually paying for Medicaid for other states, for people in other states, but we're not covering the people here, you know, even though we're paying for it. Hey, just one of the things that I ran into, and this came out about a month ago, but this is an exact quote from Bloomberg's News, but it said in the United States, 95% of post-financial crash wealth generated, and so has that been since 2009, went into the bank accounts of the richest 1%. You know, and that just right there, you know, if you're only leaving 5% of wealth for 99% of the rest of the people, it just seems like you have a built-in disincentive for people even to work. And
what do you think about that, Larry?
Well, I think that's right. That's it's you know, I part of my academic training is in American history, and a lot of what's going on today harkens back to the Gilded Age before leading up to the Great Depression and the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. And certainly what the caller says, Sean, appreciate your comments about Medicaid. I'm not sure that that a Republican governor wouldn't accept Medicaid expansion. I just know this governor won't. And so I wouldn't give up on the Republican Party embracing Medicaid expansion because it makes a lot of sense fiscally for the state. And, of course, it makes a lot of sense for public health improvement as well. But what you say about the wealth distribution is, I believe, economically unsustainable. It will not endure. And not only is it economically not sustainable, I think it's socially and ethically not sustainable either. And so we have a big challenge ahead of us to figure out ways to spread that benefit. The benefit that comes from hard work needs to be shared. As I said earlier, American productivity among workers is way up, and wages have not kept pace at all.
What kinds of changes would make sense in the way we grant supportive housing to people who are working but poor?
You know, housing's a big issue. And, of course, as you know, Chris, we've done quite a bit of housing development at City Square. Housing is – I told a group of realtors that when you put a person in a home, whether it be a rental property or a purchase – it's like providing them with an injection of health opportunity, really. Mm-hmm. Housing, especially permanent supportive housing for the homeless population, is like an intervention. And, you know, upwards of 85% of people on the street today, if they had permanent housing, would stabilize largely on their own. The same is true in a slightly different way about affordable housing. People who live in substandard housing face all sorts of health issues, such as asthma, for example. We're involved in a collaborative with Children's Medical Center around childhood asthma, and we're finding direct linkages between substandard housing and the incidence of asthma. The whole neighborhood culture and environment that comes along with substandard housing is a problem. I learned a long time ago, back when Roseland Homes was completely torn down. It's a public housing development owned by the Dallas Housing Authority. It was completely torn down and built back. And the change in the environment, the built environment, was medicinal. It was like the whole neighborhood got better. It got so much better, we moved out of what we were doing there and moved south. So how we build environments, where we put freeways, how we construct our communities all affect people and drive the poverty numbers one way or another. I think we have a housing crisis in Dallas when it comes to affordable housing. It's interesting, the largest home builder in Dallas for the last 5 years has been Habitat for Humanity.
Hmm.
That's interesting. But with 260,000 adults, you know, living in poverty, with a third of our children living in poverty, with 39% of our population dealing with asset poverty, we got some real issues around everything. Healthcare and housing have been mentioned this morning, but of course, and as has education. So all these things fit together, and they feed off each other, either positively or negatively.
And even for people who assume that the problems of the poor are the fault of the poor, there are considerations for the economic health of the city as a whole when you have that large a percentage of the population living in poverty.
That's correct. And that's one of the themes the mayor's picked up on recently, as I said earlier. We're all in this together. And if we don't create a healthier city, if our approach is not holistic enough to really begin to address these complexities, we all will suffer. I think the mayor's line is that employers will go somewhere else. And I think he's right. And so the return on investment in the lives of low-income working people, it could be great for us. The failure to invest is cataclysmic. And in some of these neighborhoods that we're talking about, it's going to take massive overinvestment to bring them back, to leverage them. My friend Paul Jarkowski, who was at UTD for years and now at Rutgers, wrote this great book called Poverty in Place. And in that book, he argues convincingly that when a neighborhood reaches 25 to 40% impoverished, it tips. It tips over and can't be brought back without massive overinvestment. And we live at a time and in a culture that's not wanting to invest at the bottom at all. The often ignored reality is investment at the bottom benefits the overall economy quickly. And so with Medicaid expansion or making sure everyone eligible for food stamp benefits is enrolled or any number of other public initiatives, all those dollars, when they come back to our city, help us all.
Larry James is my guest. He leads the new Dallas Poverty Task Force, and he is president and CEO of City Square. He'll appear as a panelist on Thursday evening at 7 at the Dallas City Performance Hall for the One Crisis Away event. You can reserve a ticket online. It is free, and it's a public forum. You can reserve that ticket at cfttexas.org. We'll come back to our conversation with Larry in a few minutes. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Summer Youth, with more than 30 new programs for students entering kindergarten through 12th grade at SMU in Plano from June through August. Registration opens March 5th at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with CEO and President of City Square, Larry James. He's been chosen to lead the new Dallas Poverty Task Force, and he is a scheduled panelist in KERA's One Crisis Away live event this Thursday evening at 7 at the Dallas City Performance Hall. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Kay Sizall. Hi, Kay. Sizall?
No, this is Kay Sizall, McZill.
Kay Sizall, oh, hi.
Yes, I want to thank you for having me on your show, Chris. And Mr. James, I want to thank you very much. I will be looking at what's going on with this poverty task force that you have, because I'm very concerned, I'm very disturbed at what's going on in Dallas. Years ago, I was a young girl, and I worked at William P. Clements' company, Setco Incorporated. I was the only African-American on that floor, and I was friends with everyone. It didn't matter to me. I grew up that way with living in an environment like this. And so we were friends, and we did things together and so forth. When it came down to raises, went to El Phoenix across the street from that company, and they told me how much they got, and I was the only one. I felt really bad because they didn't pay me the way they paid my white counterparts.
Is that the kind of story you've heard from other people?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think wages in America, a topic that should be explored from many different aspects. I mean, if you just compare the wages of men and women, you've got a disparity. Certainly, if you compare the wages of African American workers with white workers, there's disparity. The same is true with Hispanic workers. And so the caller is right. Our experience, I think, is not atypical. It's unfortunate, and I'm quite sure she should have been treated better.
We could talk for hours and hours on this program about whether undocumented immigrants should be residents of our community. But the fact is, undocumented immigrants are residents of our community.
Right.
When they are in financial crisis, they typically qualify for no services unless they have sort of American-born relatives in their household.
That is correct. And only the American-born are eligible. And so, you know, immigration reform is one of the big issues that I believe would help drive poverty away from us. It would allow an underground economy to emerge. I think the immigrant population in terms of labor is incredibly effective. It also is being exploited by the rest of us. immigrant workers who pay into Social Security using bogus numbers, if you will, or even tax ID numbers that they get, do not have any chance to get those dollars back. As a matter of fact, they're propping up my Social Security benefits. All those sorts of things need to be considered, and I think our economy would be helped if we had immigration reform. Mental health reform and mental health funding is another issue. We've turned to prisons to handle many of our mental health issues and problems, especially related to narcotics. That should be addressed as well, because it drives the poverty numbers in neighborhoods like the ones where we live and work at City Square.
What do you see as the best? You talked about investment from the bottom up in lower income neighborhoods. Sometimes people worry about the danger of gentrification, where neighborhoods become economically diverse for a short time, and then suddenly local original residents are driven out because they can't afford it any longer. Without telling people where to go and where to move, how can we make our city's neighborhoods reflect a more even balance of the spectrum of income that we see across Dallas?
Yeah, it's a very complex issue, and we deal with a kind of new segregation that's defined by dollars, right? It also reflects race because of the disparity in wealth among the different ethnic groups that make up our community. And so gentrification is a problem, but I would argue that it may be a better problem than results when there is no gentrification. Because at least with gentrification, you have assets moving back toward areas of the city that have been neglected or undercapitalized. And when those resources come back to those parts of the city, jobs begin to appear as well. And so we need a thoughtful approach. We need more urban planning. And, Dallas has not really been strong on land planning. And we could do better there. But that relates as well.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Kelvin on the line in Rockwall. Hi, Kelvin.
So how you doing? I just want to express a concern from a national and especially from a local level is that, I don't want to speak of minimum wages increases and the plight of the poor and stuff like that. For me, the key aspect and the key to the future is knowledge. I mean, I think that should be more of a focus on really improving the processes within the community as to how individuals are educated and trained. I mean, the key knowledge, skills, and abilities is what's really needed, because once you educate people, you now have a demand for educated citizens, for an educated citizenry, which now forces the businesses to now compete for those knowledge workers.
What do you think, Larry?
Yeah, I think you're right. We need a more comprehensive and robust approach to preparing young people for living wage jobs. And that for some young people means college, and for others it means other kinds of technical skills. But in low-income neighborhoods, those options, which seem apparent to all of us, aren't quite so readily accessible, and the benefits aren't easily realized. We were talking off-air about just access to technology to be able to perform the functions required by schools. Investments in neighborhoods around code enforcement and safety, public safety, green spaces, public education, investing as much in an inner city school that's populated by very low income children as we might invest in a suburban school. These kinds of equity issues drive what the caller is asking for. And if I'm dealing with all the attendant problems of poverty, and if my parents are, then I've got a different kind of challenge than, say, my grandchildren who are well cared for by hardworking parents who make living wages. So it all fits together. It's all of the above, and you can't really isolate on one thing or another. I will say, to the caller's credit, the idea of preparing workers for this economy and for the jobs that are available is absolutely essential. And we've got to get to the place where we're doing that. But we're so far behind right now with a large segment of our population that we're going to have to do extraordinary things to get where we need to be.
What do we do about youth unemployment? And is there a careful line between making good jobs available to teenagers and people in their early 20s and making those jobs seem more desirable than staying in school and finishing, you know, at least high school and if not some college or professional education?
Yeah, in some parts of our community, work trumps education. I will say, however, I don't know that there are many jobs that are so attractive that they would rule out going further if a student sees the legitimate prospect of being able to accomplish.
It has to feel possible.
It's got to feel possible. And so sometimes the lack of hope or the feeling of impossibility drives people prematurely into the labor market, and they settle for jobs that aren't going to go where they want to go in terms of living wages. So that's complicated as well. I'll say something else about youth employment. 20 years ago, the Department of Labor had across America a summer jobs program for kids. And I think that was one of the greatest things because these young people, we hired several in my nonprofit organization. And these young people not only worked hard all summer and earned a wage for their efforts, but they were exposed to community people and to business people and to bosses and to fellow workers. And they learned the skills of being part of a work team. All that money's been eliminated. And so we have a huge problem every summer with young people who could be doing something productive and being paid for it, who just are kind of cut loose and on their own. We need to address those kinds of public initiatives that really are very important in preparing young people for lives of work.
Sounds like a good, maybe quick fix to do temporarily in the city of Dallas.
Yeah, I think maybe the mayor could consider that.
Larry James is president and CEO of City Square and leader of the Mayor's New Dallas Poverty Task Force. He'll be a panelist on the One Crisis Away live event this Thursday evening at 7 at the Dallas City Performance Hall. You can find information about that on KERA's website. Larry, it is always lovely to have you in. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's always a pleasure.